Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us on this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. We're going to be met by a tremendous treat today. We are going to speak with Dr. Scott Hahn at length about the Gospel of Matthew. There is a course out on Emmaus Academy, which is born out of the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology, on the Gospel of Matthew. Four scholars, including Dr. Hahn and Dr. Bergsma and Dr. Jeffrey Morrow, will be examining the wondrous framework and reality behind the Gospels, how they intersect, but also how they expand and play off each other, and also how they are each unique, how Matthew becomes the kind of proto-runner for the rest of the Gospels, and why. Dr. Hahn will examine for us the different linguistic, historical, typological, and liturgical traits, the very patrine reality of the Gospel of Matthew, and why you and I as Catholics, despite having heard readings from this Gospel all our life, ought not take it for granted, and that study of this course, study of the Gospel of Matthew, has to be a priority for our life, and veritably all of the other books of the Bible. But prior to that, I want to open with a commentary on a particular issue about modern democracy. I came across an article in Public Discourse, and the problem with the article was a critique of the proposition of Jonathan Rauch. Jonathan Rauch is attempting a kind of theological innovation. He's coming up with what he calls a gospel of compromise, where Christians are willing to let down their hardline interests in biblical morality in the greater civic interest, if you will, of the flourishing of liberalism in democracy. Now, this isn't sound morality. In fact, if anything, this is an assault on a conscience, assault on Christian conscience, on objective truth. This is a false moral agency masked as tolerance. The fact of the matter is, this is destructive. It is calling for Christians to disavow their fidelity to Christ and His Church in the greater interest of the nation. This, unfortunately, is heinous nationalism. The fact of the matter is, we are Catholics first and Americans second. And so we talk about that after the headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Tuesday, June 10th. It's the Feast of the Martyrs of the Halls of Rockfort. Today's news brought to you by Visiting Angels, providing loving care and assistance for seniors in need. VisitingAngels.com. California Governor Gavin Newsom is filing an emergency motion to block President Trump's deployment of the National Guard and Marines to Los Angeles.
Trump and Hegseth jumped from 0 to 60, bypassing law enforcement expertise and evaluation. They threw caution to the wind and sidelined strategy in an unnecessary and inflammatory escalation.
Newsom and California Attorney General Rob Bonta argue it's illegal, undermines state authority, and could increase tensions as well as unrest. A video shows a mass group handing out riot gear and gas masks to protesters in downtown L.A., Daniel Martindale reports.
KTTV captured the video on Monday just feet away from federal buildings. National Guard troops were standing outside the federal buildings, but no local police were visible at the time. One report says people arrived with truckloads of UVX bionic face shields. It's unclear who the people who handed out the gear are affiliated with.
Today's primary election in New Jersey could be a clue to the mood of the country. There's a crowded field of candidates on the ballot looking to replace outgoing Governor Phil Murphy.
I live in East Orange, and I'm looking for lower taxes.
I guess make a change for the positive, lower costs somehow, you know, invest in our schools. I think that has not been a priority.
The property tax is high, and also controlling all the new construction.
Republicans are hoping they can flip the governor's office from blue to red in November. And millions are bracing for severe weather in the plains and on the East Coast. The latest round comes as central and eastern parts of the country have been slammed by storms over the past several days. Forecasters say flash flooding is possible all over the country in the next 48 to 72 hours. From your AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Steve Clark.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. I came across this article on public discourse and I tried to read it carefully, not because it was unclear, but because I found myself marveling at how a certain kind of intellectual liberalism can attempt, with a straight face, to describe theologically incoherent ideas as if they were innovative treasures. The article was a critique of Jonathan Rauch's new attempt at theological midwifery. He tries to birth a hybrid beast, liberal democracy wrapped in the garb of Christian theology, laboring to deliver the child of political compromise. Surprise, surprise. What Rauch calls a gospel of compromise is, in fact, neither gospel nor true compromise. It's capitulation, masquerading as a theology. It's false, though. It's a retreat from truth, dressed up as a kind of accepting pluralism. It's actually an assault on our moral agency and conscience under the mask of tolerance. His proposal is simple, that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the LDS, provides the best model for thick theology compatible with liberal democracy. Now, I know quite a bit about LDS theology, but I also recognize when a theological idea is being manipulated for secular purposes, and that's exactly what's happening here. Because Rauch claims that LDS views on agency, moral agency, provide a backbone for liberalism and Christianity, faith in the public sphere. In reality, what he's advocating is the mutilation of moral conscience itself, sowing it off from moral and metaphysical roots, so therefore the roots of Christianity, so that it can serve the empty shrine of democratic negotiation. He takes a doctrine that rests on law, sin, and salvation and repurposes it to prop up a governmental system that's actually allergic to all three. Democracy is defined by mob rule, unlike a virtuous republic. The underlying theme of Rauch's argument is that we should embrace a system of perpetual negotiation as the essence of both democracy and theology. I mean, he's not just mistaken, he's tragic. In Catholic and classical philosophy alike, moral agency, the ability of the human person to intellectually, rationally assess decisions and make a moral judgment and decision, is not about the freedom to choose arbitrarily, it's about the freedom to choose the good, a freedom that presupposes an objective moral order. St. Thomas Aquinas put it succinctly, the more a man acts according to reason, the more free he is. This is in the Summa. Contrast that with Rauch's reductionist view, in which freedom becomes an end in itself, detached from the end or telos of human nature and the demands of God's truth over us. What Rauch is actually advocating is the devolution of our morality into preference. He reinterprets the rich, demanding tradition of biblical Christian anthropology into a language of negotiated political identities and negotiated truths, relativism. To be fair, this is par for the course in our late democratic age, where the only heresy is certainty. Rauch's article is a perfect microcosm of what happens when the Catholic heritage of moral clarity is sacrificed on the false altar of democratic pluralism. See, democracy is not a means to order civic life. It's actually being treated as a kind of metaphysical absolute. In short, democracy, mob-rule democracy, is being defined as a modern religion of liberalism. Once it was a system for adjudicating disputes amongst fallen men. What we have in this republic is a modification of the premise of democracy. It is now seen as a theology for modern human autonomy. It's almost liturgical. Democracy is the means of negotiation. It has its own saints, its own heretics, its own quote-unquote sacraments. So Jonathan Rauch has simply written a new collect, if you will, for this democratic missal. He's invoking the name of moral agency in vain. Chesterton once observed, "The modern world is full of the Christian virtues gone mad. This is an example." And here's the problem. When you unmoor agency from eternal law, you don't liberate man, you fragment him. The Catholic intellectual tradition has always insisted liberty without truth is not liberty at all, but license, a counterfeit freedom. It ultimately enslaves us. John Paul II was prophetic in Veritatis Splendor when he warned us, an essential aspect of freedom is the ability to recognize and choose what is good. But if this capacity is weakened by sin, moral truth is obscured, freedom itself becomes a destructive force. So yes, Rausch's manipulation of theology is not a misreading, it's a deliberate reprogramming of biblical moral language for his own secular end. So yes, he borrows the language of Christianity, but he wants to buttress a liberalistic democratic framework. In many places, he even abandons natural law. He wants agency without accountability to God, freedom without a final end. He wants pluralism without objective truth. He wants all the great fruits of Christian civilization and Christendom without appealing to the tree of the church that bore them. It's one of the driest ironies. Rausch is attempting to co-opt the most doctrinally conservative religious movement in America, in this case the LDS is bundled into that, to promote a project of moral revisionism, relativism. He calls them a strong community, he lauds them for moral rigor, but he subtly encourages them to jettison the very objective beliefs, and that includes all of us. He tells all of us, jettison our very objective moral beliefs so that we can espouse what he would consider democratic virtues. It's like applauding a man for his sturdy house, but suggesting he bulldoze the foundation and replace it with sand. Many Christians are falling for this. That's the problem. The temptation to appear reasonable, tolerant, in the eyes of secular society is irresistible. I mean, who wants to be called a fundamentalist? Who wants to be called a bigot? Well, the price of respectability is steep. It's the slow erosion of our moral clarity and the quiet abandonment of those transcendent truths that Christ gave us if we want to earn worldly respect. To paraphrase C.S. Lewis, we're called to be thermostats, not thermometers. But many Christians want to become the latter. They want to measure and mirror the temperature of the age rather than shape it in light of Christ's gospel. The deepest issue in Rausch's claim here is not political, but also anthropological, how he understands a human person. He thinks a man is only a truly human person when he negotiates, including negotiating his morality and truth. The church teaches we're all fallen, that the only image of true humanity is Jesus Christ. And so we become images of true humanity when we worship. Rausch places the forum at the center of human meaning. The church places the altar, the liturgy, the sacraments, Christ at the center of human meaning. Rausch exalts compromise. The saints exalt conversion. Rausch thinks we flourish by revising and negotiating our values. The church teaches we flourish by holding true to virtue and conforming ourselves not to the world, but to Christ who is the Logos. If Rausch's vision of democracy becomes the church's moral compass, we will have traded the cross for the caucus, the creed for the committee. His is not a gospel of compromise, it's the gospel of capitulation. Doctrine is set aside in favor of this perpetual, ambiguous view of synodality and a liturgy of sentiment more than truth and sacredness. There is another way. The genuinely Catholic vision of moral agency begins with the truth that freedom is ordered to love, not sentimental affirmation. Love in truth, defined by Christ, sacrificial, ordered, claiming its accountability to God above all. When moral agency is understood in this way, we recognize pluralism, though a fact, unfortunately, of a secularized life, is not a virtue. Tolerance might be a necessity to some degree, but truth is the goal. We are called to respect persons, not opinions. We cannot negotiate truth into meaninglessness just to get a seat at the table of polite society and to fight to foster relationships that ultimately doom us to embracing toxic lies. We must be the voice that calls the table to repentance. If the Catholic idea of moral agency has a value for our time, it's not as Rausch envisions it. It's not a tool for liberal accommodation. It's a summons to personal holiness within a cosmos that's been suffused with divine purpose. In short, my friends, in a world that has abandoned absolutes, it's not more dialogue that we need. It's more fidelity. Not more redefinitions, but more recommitments. Not more democracy in the sanctuary, but more sanctity in the public square. In short, we need fullness of commitment to Christ and His church. Then we will transform the world. Let us not compromise the cross. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization. Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
The good of art, we are told, is in the social or political commentary that it provides. Or for others, art exists for the sake of arousing emotion, or perhaps for the expression of emotion. But everyone, it seems, wants art to do something. Not just painting and sculpture, but literature too is supposed to justify itself by likewise providing us with political and social themes for analysis. Does anyone anymore just look at a painting and say, "My, this is beautiful"? And I'm very much afraid that the most perfect art form ever, the human person, is being required to justify himself, to prove himself useful. Of course, if it seems he won't be useful, we have various pills and clinics. Or, if he has outlived his usefulness, we have places where he can be tucked out of the way. But consider this. Maybe we could once again learn how to recognize the simple beauty of being. GuadalupeWorkers.org.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. The Gospel of Matthew is more than the first book of the New Testament. It is the key that unlocks the story of Jesus as fulfillment of the law, the awaited fulfillment of all that the prophets foretold, and the long-awaited kingdom of God. The St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology has put out a course, a foundational course, that guides its learners and viewers through Matthew's Gospel with clarity, depth, and pastoral insight, and it's taught by Dr. Scott Hahn, who joins us today. Dr. Hahn is a noteworthy biblical theologian, covenant theologian, a prolific author, and the teacher of this course on St. Matthew, the Gospel of St. Matthew. Dr. Hahn, great to speak with you. How are you?
Oh, Marcus, dear brother, it's great to hear your voice. It's great to be back together again.
Likewise. I've been looking forward to this. I want to commend you on the insightful, thoughtful, and deeply enlightening course of the Gospel of Matthew that you've put out at the St. Paul Center. And so, to start with the big picture narrative, tell all of our listeners about the wonderful work that's being done at the St. Paul Center.
Yeah, thanks for asking, Marcus. We have a number of scholars who are colleagues of mine, both at Franciscan University as well as at the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology. And we've teamed up to do all four Gospels, and that's available, Emmaus Academy. Mm-hmm. And it's exciting because Dr. Shane Owens, a very dynamic teacher, is doing the Gospel of Mark. And then we also have Dr. Jeff Morrow, a convert from Judaism, doing the Gospel of Luke. It's brilliant. And then Dr. John Bergman will be doing the fourth Gospel, the Gospel of John. And so I sort of lay a foundation by approaching the first Gospel, the Gospel of Matthew. And you have effectively six lessons per Gospel, an average of about 30 minutes each, by master presenters. And I would defer to my other three colleagues for being even superior teachers to my best. But together we are doing so many things for clergy and laity. We have three clergy conferences this year and every year. We also have a number of parish events and conferences for laity. Last week we sponsored 50 clergy converts for a retreat here. And I could go on and on, but stpaulcenter.com, you go there and you'll basically see all that we're doing to promote biblical literacy for lay people, biblical fluency for clergy, so that a whole new generation of Catholics will know what it means to read the Bible from the heart of the church, especially in terms of typology.
Amen.
And therefore, answering that question of Catholic biblical illiteracy, which has frankly confounded many converts who come into the church from Protestantism, myself included. And so I want to say thank you for the wondrous work that the center is doing, but particularly this lesson on the Gospel of Matthew. And so I want to just focus in on the beginning of these lessons. You narrate the fact that structurally Matthew is made up of five discourses, and that provides a kind of roadmap for navigating the entire book. Let's begin there.
Yeah, I mean, what you discover in the Gospel of Matthew is its distinctiveness.
Mm-hmm.
It overlaps a lot with Mark and Luke, somewhat with John, but it also is unique because you have five sermons distributed evenly throughout the whole Gospel. And so most people don't realize, I suspect, that Matthew's the only one of the four evangelists to give us the Sermon on the Mount.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the first of the five sermons in Matthew chapter 5, and it runs all the way to the end of chapter 7. But you also have what you call the mission discourse in chapter 10, and then you also have something that is unique to Matthew because he reserves the parables until chapter 13, when suddenly he lets loose with a third sermon by Jesus where you have seven consecutive kingdom parables.
Mm.
And it's so significant. It's an aspect of Matthew's own literary artistry, the symmetry of these five sermons. The fourth one is known as the church sermon,
mm-hmm.
or the church discourse in Matthew 18, because Matthew is the only one of the four evangelists to actually employ the technical term ecclesia,
yeah.
church, which he does three times in two chapters, Matthew 16, and then twice in Matthew 18.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the fifth and final sermon, which I playfully call the Sermon on the Mount of Olives. It's also known more famously as the Olivet Discourse. And just like the first sermon, the Sermon on the Mount, it goes three chapters,
right.
beginning in Matthew 23 through chapter 24 until the end of chapter 25, setting us up for the Passover and the institution narrative of the Eucharist that you find in Matthew 26. So you get a sense of artistry, symmetry, and balance because the first and the last of the five sermons are three chapters each,
mm-hmm.
whereas the middle three, chapter 10, 13, and 18, are all one chapter. Now, mm-hmm. obviously, the chapter divisions came much later, but in terms of verses and word count, there really is that symmetry that is obvious. And I think discovering that is the doorway into discovering that Matthew's genius is something that needs to be appreciated. I mean, you'll find scholars who have become agnostics who still comment upon Matthew's brilliance, his
right.
literary artistry. And you really see this when, in fact, you discover not only these five pillar sermons supporting the whole first gospel, but the way that he weaves the narrative
yeah.
through the discourses in a way that is, practically speaking, breathtaking. I think since most people have grown up hearing the Gospels since their childhood, they tend to hear them like you might hear an orchestra. You know,
right.
as a young person, you can't differentiate between the brass, the strings, the percussion, and the woodwinds. But once you learn to distinguish between Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the truth of this fourfold ensemble becomes positively symphonic. And you can see in a breathtaking way how the new was concealed in the old and how the old is revealed and fulfilled in the new. And Matthew really is the premier master of typology. That's what I love so much about this gospel.
And I'm glad that you brought that up, because the way in which he appeals to typology demonstrates a real sense of immersion in his Jewish heritage, his Israelite heritage. And so you see hints of references, if you will, to rabbinic sources and texts. You know, like when he utilizes formulas, like you have heard it said, but I say to you, that's a kind of midrashim halakha, that formula that he's appealing to. And so he's bringing that out and showing that Christ is the new covenant fulfillment that all Israel has been hoping for.
That's so true, and that's worth really emphasizing, because you have this emphasis on the Old Testament from the opening verse. I mean, the very fact that you have the book of the genealogy
right.
of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham, Biblos Genesos, the first two words, could just as easily be translated the book of Genesis. And so when you trace this genealogy back through David all the way to Abraham, of course, there's a period known as the exile. Mm-hmm. And most Jews who have been dispersed among the nations, as well as the Jews who are under Roman dominion and occupation there in Judea or Palestine, they have lost track of the Davidic dynasty. There just hasn't been a Davidic monarch now for practically five centuries. And so to discover, not only has God been faithful in the face of our infidelity, but he's also kept track of this this unbroken line,
yes,
of the Davidic monarchy. It just gives you a hope that, okay, this is just the foundation being laid. Now, most people would say a genealogy is probably the most boring part of the gospel until you realize that this is the cornerstone on which the fulfillment of the old begins.
Yeah.
And so it is a new Genesis. It's also a new Exodus, a new Moses who brings it about. But what Matthew privileges and emphasizes from the beginning through the middle to the end, more than the other three evangelists, is the kingdom of David, the Davidic kingdom covenant. And so you have lots of beautiful echoes of new Genesis, a new creation, a new Adam, as it were.
Yeah.
But the best part is the Davidic kingdom.
My guest is Dr. Scott Hahn, covenant theologian, biblical theologian, teacher, catechist, prolific author, and we're talking about the St. Paul Center's recent course, The Gospel of Matthew, part of their Emmaus Academy. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
This program brought to you in part by Ave Maria Florida, a big kind of small town, where golf carts take you everywhere and there's always something fun around the corner. Discover championship golf, resort-style amenities, and a town center full of shopping and dining. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at its heart, it's a community full of connection and charm. More than 25 model homes are available for viewing. More information can be found at avemaria.com. That's avemaria.com.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Are you paying high prices with a traditional health insurance company that pays for things that violate your conscience? There's an alternative available. Solidarity HealthShare is a community of faithful individuals and families that never share into immoral medical services, all while saving you money with prices starting as low as $85 per month for singles and $512 for families. Never fund another abortion with your healthcare dollars. Call 844-313-4999 to learn more.
Support for this Ave Maria radio program comes in part by the non-for-profit St. Anthony Services. Are you shopping for mortgage products, Catholic investing, Catholic health, real estate, or estate planning? StAnthonyServices.org can help you find a Catholic professional for these needs. They regularly connect faithful citizens with faith-based professionals that share our Christian values. More information at StAnthonyServices.org or 877-LIFE-US1.
Strained or broken relationships are a given in most of our lives. Friends fall away, siblings drift apart, children sever ties with their parents, and despite our best efforts, these painful fissures are difficult to mend. Hi, I'm Dr. Ray. If you want to learn how to communicate better with the difficult people in your life and be a more easygoing, more forgiving person, check out my book, How to Get Along with Almost Everybody. Check it out. And all my other books on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
Fire on the Earth, Peter Herbeck. Without the light that comes from Christ, we walk in darkness. And darkness is a way of describing this fallen world in which we don't know why we're here even. We can't touch meaning because we ultimately can't see God, and we can't be satisfied because we were made for God. We were made as this entire creation. The whole cosmos was made to the glory of God. It all exists to reveal the glory and the majesty, the beauty, the complexity, the creative love and power of God. And all of it gives praise to him, except for fallen angels and rebellious human hearts. We're made literally to live for the glory of God, to worship him, to give thanks to him. That's what heaven is. It's not just a big prayer meeting, but it is the full celebration of free souls and creatures just overwhelmed by the majesty and beauty of God. And we're sharing in it. We're not just watching it like we do on a movie, that when it's over, it's over. We're in it. We're sharing in the life. And it's total and absolute fulfillment. We can't hardly even imagine what that's like. The best we can do in this world is to have some measure of distraction or something that makes me feel good temporarily. Or temporary goals that we kind of have hope in. Those intermediate goals are good goals, but they don't solve the big problem. They don't produce genuine heart that brings peace to the soul and transformation.
Peter Herbeck spreads fire on the earth, weekday mornings at 6:30 and again at 11:45 on Ave Maria Radio. Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. I'm speaking with Dr. Scott Hahn. He's a theologian, scripture scholar, teacher, and through the St. Paul Center that he runs and founded, there is a new course that's been put out on the Gospel of Matthew, and that's what we're talking about today. So, Dr. Hahn, I want to pick up where we left off. You had dropped this bombshell on us, and then the break hit, about Matthew beginning with the words Biblos Genesios, but it's not just the book of Genesis, it's the book of the Genesis of Jesus the Christ. And so he makes these powerful, startling messianic claims I remember encountering it for the first time and realizing he makes it in an almost ho-hum authoritative manner. And he makes it presuming that he has this authority to say this, and he's saying this because it's true. So, Jesus the Christ, the Son of David, the Son of Abraham, and directly shows that this is the person all the sons of Abraham have been awaiting.
That's right. You know, and what you have in the evangelist, St. Matthew, is by universal consensus of the tradition, you know, Levi, a scribe, a tax collector. So someone who obviously has honed his own scribal skills. And as we see in the TV series, The Chosen, mm-hmm. he may have been tapped to really keep track from the very outset right. of Jesus' public ministry. But regardless, you get a sense that in that first chapter where you have the genealogy going all the way back to Abraham, there is a numerical symbolism. You have three right. sets of 14 generations yep. from Abraham to David, 14, from David to the exile, 14, and from the exile to Joseph and Mary, 14, followed by the Annunciation to Joseph. Luke, of course, gives us the more familiar Marian Annunciation, but you see here all of these things leading straight to the angel's proclamation to Saint Joseph.
Right.
And when you look at the reason why, well, in Hebrew, you don't have numbers. You assign numerical values to the letters of the alphabet
right.
concerning where they emerge. And so David's name consists of three letters that add up to the number 14. Now, Matthew never mentions this explicitly because his original readers didn't need anybody to do this. And so once you get behind the curtain, once you pick up on the behind the scenes, you realize why it is that though he emphasizes the Abrahamic covenant, the Mosaic covenant, he really privileges the Davidic covenant
yes.
as the main event. And in terms of salvation history, the Davidic covenant is the final form of the covenant that brings us to the threshold of the New Testament.
Right.
And so, Son of David, in fact, the term kingdom, Basileia, occurs 60 times, and the kingdom of heaven, 33 times. So you have this emphasis that this is not simply a political restoration. This is really the fulfillment of the earthly prototype
right.
of the Davidic dynasty in the heavenly Jerusalem. And God is with us back then. God is with us in a new way through the incarnation. But Matthew, again, is the only one to give us the Great Commission. Go and make disciples of all nations, and no wonder, because the Davidic kingdom was not just one nation.
Mm-hmm.
It was one nation ruling all of the other nations, as we sing so frequently in Psalm 2 and yeah. elsewhere, asking them, like, all the nations your inheritance. So the international breadth of the church is already prefigured in the covenant with Abraham, all the nations of the earth will be blessed through you, but especially the royal family of David. And when you pick up on all of these sub-themes, you end up seeing something emerging with a composite unity that, again, just takes your breath away, and you realize this man was not only a literary artist, not only an eyewitness, one of the 12, but someone who must have been a contemplative, a theologian himself, who basically applied himself to the study of the law and the prophets to illustrate exactly what Jesus says in Matthew 5:17, think not that I've come to abolish the law and the prophets, I've come to fulfill. And that pattern of fulfillment, pleirosis, just really turns the Gospel of Matthew into something three-dimensional. Right. It comes alive, and it's just such a beautiful thing to see students discovering this for the first time, along with all of these other unique features to Matthew. Matthew, for example, is the only one who gives us the Lord's Prayer in its fullest version. Mm-hmm. You mentioned you've heard that it was said to manifold, but I say to you, those six antitheses are only found in Matthew's Gospel. The eight Beatitudes are only found in Matthew's Gospel. The Magi following the star to Bethlehem. Again, these distinctive features that emphasize certain aspects of his own approach to Christ, the Son of David, the Son of God, the King of Israel. And so you have this kingdom of David restored, but the kingdom of David ends up becoming what we would call the Catholic Church, especially Peter. And we could talk about this later on, perhaps, but Matthew is also nicknamed not only the Gospel of the Church, because he's the only evangelist to use the term ecclesia three times, but it's also known, even among Protestants, as the Gospel of Peter. Peter walks on the water, only in Matthew. Thou art Peter, and upon this rock I'll build my church, only in Matthew. The keys of the kingdom, only in Matthew. Paying the half-shekel tax, that Peter passage is only found in Matthew. Jesus says you have to forgive your brother seven times, but in Matthew 18 he says to Peter, you must be willing to forgive 70 times seven. In a way that is godlike, the way God forgives his people their iniquities. And again, when you pick up on these strands, you find that this threefold cord, this evangelical rope, if you will, is such a solid way to build your relationship with Jesus upon a close and prayerful study.
You know, you pack a lot into a short amount of time, Dr. Hahn, and I want to really zoom in on this concept of liturgical kingdom that really comes out in the Gospel of Matthew that you touch upon in your lesson. So he begins with that gematria of David. Jesus is the most David of the Davids, you know, 14, 14, 14. And then he appeals to terms like ecclesia, no one else does that, basileia for the kingdom. And then the Petrine primacy that comes out in the text. I remember encountering Matthew 16 in juxtaposition to Isaiah 22 and realizing you really get a sense of what Matthew is trying to do in the way he thinks about the new and eternal Davidic kingdom.
It's so true, Marcus. You know, I wrote a commentary several years ago on an Old Testament book known as Chronicles, 1 and 2 Chronicles. The title of that is The Kingdom of God as Liturgical Empire, because that's the chronicler's historical and theological perspective. And, you know, in many collections of the Old Testament canon, Chronicles is the last book. And so you would find that if Matthew had that sequence, then the Old ends with Chronicles, and then the new begins with Matthew. And when you look at the resemblances, it's just downright striking, because Chronicles begins with a comprehensive genealogy that goes all the way back to the book of Genesis, but emphasizing the Davidic genealogy, and at the same time acknowledging the exile, the collapse of the kingdom, the defeat of Jerusalem, and the destruction of the temple. So God's people are in exile, reading the story as though it's in search of an ending, and then Matthew says, I'll pick up where the chronicler leaves off. And his emphasis on the kingdom, not as primarily political or military, but liturgical, that the Levites are now reorganized, basically perpetual adoration, 24/7 at the time of the temple. David's greatest contribution is not military, but basically reorganizing the worship of the 12 tribes, and then Solomon, his son, imparting divine wisdom and inviting Gentiles up to the holy city to learn the ways of God. It ends up showing that the Davidic kingdom covenant really was divinely intended to be a prototype of the Catholic Church. And so when you read it that sense, you realize, okay, why does Matthew alone give us the Sermon on the Mount? Why does Matthew alone emphasize and tell us what Jesus said? I've not come to abolish the law and the prophets, but to fulfill. Now, all of the other evangelists illustrate that, but only Matthew has Jesus explicitly and emphatically stating it. And Matthew then illustrates it so beautifully.
My guest is Dr. Scott Hahn. We are talking about the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology's recent course on the Gospel of Matthew that's put out via their Emmaus Academy platform. It's a wondrous exploration of this gospel that paves the way for the exploration of the other gospels. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Honey, did you ever call Mighty Dog Roofing of Ann Arbor for that free roof inspection?
I knew I forgot something.
Roof leaks can cause mold buildup or even roof collapse. Protect your family today by calling local Catholics Dan and Mary Flanagan at Mighty Dog Roofing for a free inspection of your roof, siding, or windows. Mighty Dog Roofing, 734-224-4916. That's 734-224-4916.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
Remember to take a minute this week to thank a priest you know for all the blessings he shares through his vocation. Let us encourage them and express our gratitude for all of their sacrifices. Saying something like, "Thank you for baptizing our children." Nominate your priest at thankyouforyourpriesthood.com. A new contest every month through September 2025, brought to you by Diocesan, your Catholic advertising and communications company.
This summer, take a vacation that lifts your spirit and soul. Join Corporate Travel for the annual Grand Getaway on beautiful Mackinac Island, August 3rd to the 5th. Experience historic Grand Hotel, powerful talks from Father Mike Schmitz, Steve Ray, Dr. Edward Sree, and Father Leo Padalinghug, plus live broadcasts with Teresa Tamio, daily mass, four-course dinners, and dancing. Faith, fellowship, and fun in one retreat. Only a few rooms remaining. Don't miss out.
Book this Ave Maria Radio trip now by checking the travel page on AveMariaRadio.net.
What are the three parables Jesus tells about prayer in St. Luke's Gospel? The first is what the Catechism calls the importunate friend. This is the friend who wakes a pal at midnight in order to borrow three loaves of bread to feed a visitor. The second parable the Catechism labels the importunate widow, who persistently pleads for her rights from a reluctant judge till the wearied judge rules in her favor. This parable illustrates the need to pray always and with the patience of faith. Jesus closes this parable with the poignant question, "When the Son of Man comes, will he find any faith on the earth?" The third parable centers on the Pharisee and the tax collector, commending the tax collector for his humility because he asked God to be merciful to me, a sinner, a prayer which the Church adopts as its own. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Resetting your password, unsubscribing from emails, printing anything. Why are simple things sometimes so complicated? Thankfully, with an auto owner's insurance independent agent, getting the right coverage for your business doesn't have to be one of them. So you can get back to more important things, like learning how that printer works. That's simple human sense.
Call Choice Insurance Agency at 734-641-4200.
When women are faced with an unexpected pregnancy, Arbor Woman Health offers free medical-grade pregnancy tests, counseling, and same-day ultrasounds. But they can't protect the sacredness of life without your ongoing support. Join them for their 2025 Flourish Fundraiser Dinner on Friday, June 13th at 5:30 p.m. at St. John's Resort in Plymouth. Visit arborwoman.com to purchase tickets or become a corporate sponsor today.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. I'm speaking with Dr. Scott Hahn, theologian, scripture scholar, prolific author, and the teacher of this recent course put out by the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology via Emmaus Academy called The Gospel of St. Matthew. And Dr. Hahn, I want to pick out one of the themes that you mentioned earlier, kind of sub-theme, if you will, and that has to do with the person of Joseph, who, like you mentioned, Peter holds, it's a gospel of Peter, he holds a place of primacy throughout the gospels. But Jesus' kingly authority is appealed to in a very decisive manner through this man who is Tzaddik, this righteous man named Joseph, through whom Jesus has rightful claim to the Davidic throne. I'd like to pick up from there.
Yeah, and Marcus, let me just inject something here, because you and I both know about the Ignatius Catholic Study Bible and how extensively I'm drawing from the notes at the bottom of the pages of the Ignatius Catholic Study Bible. And in case it's news to people, I just want to also mention that the entire Bible is now complete. Yeah. It was published less than 6 months ago, both Old Testament and New in one volume, and I'd invite people, if they're interested in this course on Matthew, to get a copy or to consult their own copy if they already have one. Just talked to Ignatius yesterday, and in less than 6 months, they have sold 115,000 copies. Mm. We're having trouble keeping it in print. It's something of a phenomenon, a literary sensation. And I say this because if somebody would just go to the stpaulcenter.com, they'd find on the surface, it would appear as though this course is behind a paywall. Mm-hmm. But I want to mention two things. Number one, if you go to the St. Paul Center website, stpaulcenter.com, you'll see on the home page a sign pointing to these courses on the gospel and mine on Matthew. And you'll discover that if you enroll in the Emmaus Academy, you get your first 30 days free. And you can just basically go through this course and figure out if you want to stay subscribed. There's another thing, too, that is, if you don't have a copy of the Ignatius Catholic Study Bible, or if you wanted to get one for a family member or friend, you'll get it free simply by signing up to all-access membership on the Emmaus Academy. Then you get my course on Matthew and the other three Gospels as well. Over 30 courses taught by master teachers, including me and Bergsma and so many others as well. So I just want to make it clear to people that they could begin this today. They don't have to wait for it. And it'd be a great way to kind of start off the second half of this wonderful year of Jubilee. But since you asked about Joseph, Joseph is a figure who is more prominently featured in Matthew than the other three Gospels put together. On the one hand, he points backward, because in Genesis 37 and following, you have this key patriarchal figure by the name of Joseph, first. He is the son of Jacob, second. He's described as a tzaddik, as you put it, Marcus, a righteous man. He's misunderstood, misrepresented, but God protects him and gives him a series of dreams, the result of which the holy family of Israel ends up in Egypt in a time of trouble for food provisions of bread. And then when you look at what is distinctive to Matthew, you have Joseph, again, the same name, the son of Jacob, the same name for his father, and then likewise he's described as a righteous man, as a tzaddik. He's misunderstood by his own contemporaries. He's given a series of dreams, and only in Matthew's gospel do you have the flight to Egypt, because he takes the Holy Family where? The last place you'd expect, and that is the land of Egypt, to set the stage for a new Exodus, a greater Exodus than the one that Moses was basically bringing about through God's power. And so this sets the stage for a new Moses, a new Passover, a new Exodus as well. But as you mentioned, pointing forward, what you also have is the angelic annunciation, where in fact the angel is speaking to Joseph, who has heard that Mary is pregnant by the Holy Spirit. And the notes explain why he's not suspicious of her infidelity.
Right.
He's reverent and humble and mindful of his own unworthiness. And so when the angel approaches him, He doesn't say, Joseph, son of Jacob, don't be suspicious. You ought to know she's a fine woman. No, it's Joseph, son of David. David's not Joseph's dad, but it is his dynastic dignity.
Right.
And the genealogy proves the fact that Joseph is the one who bears the torch and will hand it off by naming Jesus. And that is a legal act in Jewish tradition that basically identifies the father. And so you find in Luke 2, Mary asking Jesus, why did you put your father and me in such distress? You know, when he was found in the temple. Not foster father, and not simply legal father, but there is a true and covenantal sense in which he reflects God's own virginal paternity in bearing the son of David, who is also the son of God. Layer after layer, there's a profound sense of typological polyvalence.
Yeah.
So that you have new creation, new Adam, you have new Exodus, new Moses, but you especially have Matthew emphasizing new kingdom, new Jerusalem, and thus a new and greater than Solomon. Again, a distinctive feature of Matthew's gospel, which will only enrich your appreciation for Mark, Luke, and John as you discover what is peculiar or distinctive in their emphases as well.
And this greatly echoes the Israelite anticipation for the royal Messiah to come, you know, that this new David, this new son of David, would bring forth an age of blessings, you know, Makarioi, the Ashrei, the blessings that would come forth from him as being a true son of David. But we also have in Psalm 1 in the wisdom literature this allusion that and even the rest of the Psalms, that the son of David would be a kind of son of God. And so Matthew is making that direct appeal, not just through the image of Joseph in Jesus' heritage, but because he's truly God-made man.
You put it well. And I think it's important to see that in the old, you have the prototype. You have the son of David, Solomon, the first to be called son of God,
right,
by the grace of a divine adoption, whereas the new fulfills the old, not just by pressing reset or returning to the status quo ante before the exile, but you see instead that the Son of God from all eternity is becoming the Son of David. So retiring, in a sense, the human or the merely earthly prototype, mm-hmm, there in the earthly Jerusalem, and setting the stage for fulfillment that really exceeded the highest hopes of the Hebrews. Even the holiest of the Hebrews had no idea what was happening, and yet you go back and read Isaiah or Jeremiah or Ezekiel, and you realize that they were pointing forward to the Messiah, not supplying proof text primarily, but typological layers, so that you can see that typology is already embedded in the messianic oracles of the prophets. As Cardinal Danya Liu said, prophecy is nothing other than the typological interpretation of history, not just pointing back to the old, but in the old, Isaiah and Jeremiah and the other prophets are pointing forward to the coming of the Messiah, mm-hmm, the establishment and fulfillment of the Davidic kingdom, as involving nothing less than what? A new creation, as Isaiah says, a new heavens and a new earth. Likewise, a new and greater Exodus. The Messiah will be greater than Moses, just,
yep,
as Moses had predicted in Deuteronomy 18. And likewise, the new David, the new Jerusalem. You find this especially in Isaiah, from whom Matthew draws in a way that is truly unprecedented. But it's also in Jeremiah, in, mm-hmm, Ezekiel, and Moses is pointing forward to it as well. So it isn't where the prophets break from the law. It's what you find in the Pentateuch taken up to the next level and fulfilled beyond their wildest dreams. And again, it makes Scripture come alive, but it also echoes the experience that Clopas and his companion had on Easter Sunday when they said, did not our hearts burn within us as he opened up the Scriptures?
Yeah.
And yet reading the Bible from the heart of the church always leads us back to Jesus in the Eucharist, so that our worship in the Mass always consists of word and sacrament, where we hear the old and the new, the promises of the old fulfilled in the new. But the fulfillment isn't simply a first century phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
It's happening in the 21st century precisely with the words of consecration.
Yeah.
The real presence of the Son of God, the Son of David, the Son of Abraham. And this is what makes the gospel so much more powerful when they illuminate the mystery of the Holy Eucharist, just as the Eucharist makes the scriptures more profound, because you're not just connecting the old and the new, you're connecting the document with the Blessed Sacrament. You're connecting Sunday with the rest of our week that will basically unfold beginning on Monday morning.
And that's why when you read the entire narrative, it's almost as if what's happening in Matthew 16 is paving the way for this new image. It seems like this is the climactic point that provides for us the lens, the paradigm for the telos of what the Messiah had always intended, this liturgical kingdom to be established in eventual sacrament.
Right, and prior to Matthew showing us Peter's declaration, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God," mm-hmm. who do men say that the Son of Man is? And they have recourse to what? The Old Testament. Some say John the Baptist, other Elijah, Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. And so at the heart of the Old Covenant is the sign that points to Christ, the Messiah, the Son of the living God. And so the grace that is given to Simon Peter to make this profession of faith in Jesus, the Son of God, the Son of David, the Messiah, you know, this is why Matthew, and again, only Matthew, goes on to say, "You are Peter. You are the rock, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it, and I give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven," etc. It's wonderful.
It truly is, and I could go on for hours. Thank you so much, Dr. Han, for making the time to speak with us.
Oh, what a joy. Thank you, Marcus.
My guest has been Dr. Scott Han, who is a prolific author and the founder of the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology. They recently put out a course, The Gospel of St. Matthew, as part of the Emmaus Academy. Thank you for joining us. I'm Marcus Peter.